the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, an explosion in bird flu cases. Now it's being found in mammals, and the call for experts is for Federal Cabinet to take a more serious national approach. And heat stress is affecting the fertility of some very expensive stallions used for breeding thoroughbreds in the Hunter Valley.
Obviously a lot of research in many areas, not just biology, focused on climate change and the things that are happening. The horse is of particular interest in me. I mean, it's my species of interest anyway. We're dealing with an animal that, generally speaking, hasn't really evolved to deal with the heat conditions that we're looking at facing, and Australia can be quite challenging.
We'll hear more about that story shortly as well. You might want to comment on any of the stories you hear on the program, 0467 922 684. Beef imports, a call there for a reduction in price of beef imports by Donald Trump. We'll find out what's behind that and what's likely to happen with that as well, where that beef is likely to come from. Not from Australia, by the sound of things. 0467 922 684 is a number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up, a day after Australia's first case of the H5 bird flu in a mammal was confirmed, another suspected detection has occurred in the fur seal in the breeding grounds just off Kangaroo Island. The case of the long-nosed fur seal is yet to be confirmed, but it was detected at the Pages Conservation Park, the site of a mass mortality event in birds. The Invasive Species Council says sea lions could face an extinction-level event if the virus takes hold. Minister for Environment Murray Watt spoke to James Glenday on the ABC News Channel about this earlier this morning.
This is obviously a very serious development that we now have seen this strain of bird flu spread to a seal. So the first time in Australia we've seen it spread to a mammal. It is not unexpected. You might remember for several weeks now my colleague Julie Collins and I have been warning that we are likely to see this kind of thing occur, and indeed that we are likely to see more mass mortalities, which is obviously a terrible thing for all Australians who love our nature. But what I can also say is it's something that we have been preparing for some time. Our government has invested about $113 million in preparedness for bird flu, and since we've seen it come to Australian shores, there's been another $24 million activated, and some of that funding has actually gone towards building up the resilience of populations of seals and sea lions by, for example, injecting baby seals and treating them for hookworm, which kills a lot of baby seals. So those kinds of things, what we've been doing over the last couple of years is about trying to build up larger populations of these mammals so that if we do have bird flu come, and if it does kill some of them, we still have resilient populations for the future.
Just on that though, we saw about 75% of seal pups die on Heard Island when this bird flu arrived there. Is that the sort of mortality we're going to be looking at in our major seal and sea lion colonies around the country?
Yeah, look, I couldn't put a percentage on it, James, but as I say, we have been saying for some time that we are likely to see mass mortalities of birds and mammals, and I know that is a very distressing thing for Australians to hear, but we also need to be realistic. This is what we've seen happen overseas. Australia is very fortunate that we've been the last continent on Earth to have this strain of bird flu happen, but we are likely to see those kind of events as we have overseas.
Last hour we had BirdLife Australia on the program. They were saying that your government's not doing enough. We've heard from the similar things from the Invasive Species Council as well. What is going to be required in the coming months as birds come together and breed throughout the spring, spreading this virus? A lot of them are going to die in our wetlands, on our beaches, right? Like, what needs to be done to make sure that that can be cleaned up as quickly as possible?
Yeah, a couple of things there, James. I would make the point that we have increased our funding since bird flu came to our shores, and that indicates that our government, along with states and territories, is prepared to keep investing more as the situation escalates. And again, let's not forget the significant sums that have been invested to date. In terms of cleanup of carcasses, it's being managed by different states and territories in their own ways. We are providing funding to some states and territories to assist with that cleanup. In some cases, the biosecurity advice is that it is safer to leave dead animals where they are, but where it is appropriate to do so, to do that cleanup, that work is happening in many parts of the country as well.
Just in the Riverina, Murray, your government has been intervening in a few different sectors to make sure that people don't lose their jobs, to make sure that Australia has manufacturing capacity, industrial capacity. Obviously, Riverina is home to a big rice-growing community. Are you close to a bailout deal with Sunrise to save jobs there?
Yeah, well, the first point I'd make, James, is that the Albanese government wants to do everything we can to protect jobs and create jobs wherever they are across the country. We have been meeting with Sunrise for some time about the situation there, just as we've been meeting with the union that represents those workers, the New South Wales government, and rice grower groups as well about the situation that is being faced there. I can confirm that we have advised Sunrise that we are prepared to co-invest with them in new investment in a rice process plant that would be about manufacturing rice cakes. Sunrise have indicated that that investment, along with their own, would protect jobs that already exist and potentially create more as well.
How much money are we talking here? Because obviously this is taxpayer money at a time we're in a lot of debt. Are we talking $10 million, more than that, $15?
Yeah, well, we haven't put a figure on that yet, James. Sunrise have sought $15 million with that they would match with their own funds. We haven't put a figure on that. And what we've said to them is that we do need to see a formal written proposal that sets out the funding that would be required, the jobs that would be protected and created, and we'll make a decision from there. But we have said that we are prepared to co-invest with them.
Minister for the Environment, Murray Watt, talking about Sunrise there at the end. We'll follow up on some of those comments with some of the people in the Riverina about the implications of that. But let's go back to bird flu now, because the Invasive Species Council says the massive ramp up of bird flu infections and spread into other species is devastating news for wildlife. Jack Gough, CEO of the Invasive Species Council, says the initial biosecurity efforts by the government were timely and appropriate, but now additional funding and a significant increase in habitat preservation is required to protect wildlife from these bird flu deaths. He argues that $100 million is needed each year for at least the next 2 years.
Yeah, so two different seals in two different locations. Three different incidents of over 1,000 birds dead now from bird flu. The bad news just keeps piling up for wildlife. But the key element of this is just the tip of the iceberg. If you look overseas, you see, you know, in South America, 600,000 birds in the first 4 months dead, tens of thousands of seals and other mammals dead in those first few months. So while the bad news is there today with a couple of seals dead, this is only going to get worse. It's going to spread to new areas, spread inland, up and down coasts, and it won't be long before people are seeing, particularly in coastal areas and around wetlands, really large numbers of dead and dying birds. So this is going to be a significant grief event for the Australian public, as well as a real driver of decline in Australian wildlife.
But the government's saying that they've kicked in $113 million and that they're now looking at spending a bit more, but you're saying that's not enough.
Look, the biosecurity response to this has been excellent, and that's because government's prepared well. They did put money into that work. The testing capabilities, the public messaging, the understanding of the spread of the virus, the work around stopping disturbance of wildlife colonies, all of that work has been good. But it's the other side of the coin that I'm very worried about, which is wildlife resilience. You know, we can't stop bird flu. We can slow its spread a little bit. But how our wildlife respond and recover to this tsunami of devastation that's coming will depend on all the other work that happens to protect wildlife. The fox and cat control in key nesting areas, the pig and deer control where they're getting into wetlands, the work making sure habitat's protected and wetlands are well watered, the work to make sure that people aren't letting their cats out and dogs off leads disturbing wildlife colonies. That's where there hasn't been enough investment. In fact, budgets around the country have been going backwards, and that's where we're saying nature basically needs a bailout. In the same way that Alcoa is getting their billions of dollars, this is a serious problem for nature and a serious problem for tourism, and we need a minimum $200 million investment over the next 2 years if the government are serious about the wildlife impact of bird flu.
And that's what BirdLife Australia are saying as well. Not enough is being spent on that sort of the next stage. There is a federal cabinet meeting where they're going to discuss this. So you're thinking that they're going to put up that sort of money now?
Look, my understanding at the moment is that it's not on the agenda of National Cabinet that's on this week, which is where the Prime Minister and all the Premiers are getting together in Dubbo in New South Wales. It needs to be on that agenda. And we've said to the Prime Minister and his office that this needs to be something at that Prime Minister and Premier level of engagement and concern, because this is going to impact up to one in five of Australia's mammals and birds that could be seeing high to extreme risk of severe population decline. That's the government's own figures around risk rating. So if it's not on that agenda, I think that is a concerning signal about how seriously it's being taken. I do know that there are good people within government taking this very seriously. We've had really productive conversations with the Environment Minister, Murray Watt, the Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins. They understand the scale of this, but look, it's going to be up to the whole of government as to what level of funding they tip into dealing with this wildlife emergency. At the moment, it's not good enough, but I still have high hopes that the government are looking seriously at a bigger level of spend to match the continental scale disaster that our wildlife is facing.
And wildlife's one thing, but poultry production, egg production is another thing. Is it likely that the cat is out of the bag now, and we are going to see, it's likely to see bird, H5N1 in our poultry and egg producers on those farms shortly?
Well, as I said, I think the biosecurity response has been pretty good. It'll be very difficult to stop it because it's obviously spreading through wildlife. So it's different to the H7 strain that you saw in Victoria, which shut down a bunch of poultry producers last year, because that H7 strain only spread through poultry, and really that biosecurity response could stop it and eradicate it. We can't stop the H5 strain of bird flu. It's going to be devastating. But I do think that poultry producers in Australia are very well prepared. There's been a lot of thought going. You've seen, agricultural shows and even, groups like Ingham shutting down their facilities to make sure that we don't get that spread. There's been a response around bringing free-range birds inside to be able to limit that contact with wildlife. So I think a lot of good work is going on, but we are going to probably start seeing some impacts in poultry, just as they have overseas. But because of the good biosecurity response, that will be limited. The issue is for wildlife, we can't stop it at all. And so it's really not about biosecurity. It's about the other work that can go on to protect those wildlife populations and allow them to recover from the wave of devastation.
So we might not see the deaths in the poultry industry that we saw last time, like at 2.5 million. It may be less than that. May be able to keep it, scale it back from that because of the response. It's just too early to say.
Look, way too early to say, and I don't think, it's not probably helpful to make predictions on it. I mean, around the world, hundreds of millions of poultry have died from this disease, and we should remember poultry are the most at-risk species for this. When it gets into poultry, given it started in Asia from poultry, that is where you get even higher levels of death. So I think, it would be very unlikely that we won't see significant impacts, particularly because we're going to have this bird flu now forever. If you look overseas, they had initial waves and follow-up waves of this virus over many years. It's still going. I don't think anyone's out of the woods. I do think, though, that the biosecurity response is proportionate to the level of threat, and that's positive.
Jack Goff is the CEO of the Invasive Species Council. It's 18 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the winner of the world-renowned Sydney Royal Wine Show has been announced. It's Pooley Wines in Tasmania. Their 2024 Shiraz won the best wine in show. 31 judges assessed 1,500 wines across 55 classes from around Australia in a blind tasting. It's a special win because the event is marking its 200th anniversary. It was the oldest continuously run wine competition in Australia. It was first run in 1826 when they offered a small gold medal for the best sample of colonial wine. Head wine judge Michael DeJulius told me that the cool climate red from Tasmania won in a very competitive field.
Yeah, it really does sort of demonstrate the diversity of the region down there, and of the state, I should say. and the amazing things that are coming out of down south there.
Yeah, so tell us about this wine. Why was it so special?
It was probably this. I mean, the Shiraz class was really competitive, and obviously Shiraz is something in Australia we do so fantastically well. But there was this one wine that, yeah, we just kept coming back to as a group of judges. It was presented, and it just had so many, like, just complexity, and every time I went back and looked at it, I saw a little different sort of feature of it, and, you know, it's got this obviously lovely sort of peppery kind of character from being down south. You get this sort of lovely sort of black pepper character sort of comes through, but there were so many other facets that kind of intrigued us, for want of a better term.
And do you think that being in a cold climate helped?
The place where we don't sit there as judges and try and guess where they're from, but, yeah, obviously the place where these grapes are grown is a vital part of what shapes the finished product of these wines. And yeah, you could definitely tell it was a cooler climate, and but it had lovely intensity and depth of flavour, and which was great.
And yet, we know Australia's famous for Shiraz, so it would have been a lot of others up there that were excellent wines.
And it was a really exciting class to judge because, yeah, there was Shirazes on the bench, and they were from, you know, McLaren Vale, there was South Yarra Valley, Western Australia, so it was, yeah, a really diverse when we saw the wines of what were the, you know, when the results were revealed, what they were, yeah, it was great to see such diverse range. And Shiraz in the country is in such a great space at the moment. And if you can't find one that you love, you're not looking hard enough.
Right. Now, Tasmania, well known, though, for its champagne, I suppose. So now we need to rethink about what they can actually grow and produce in Tasmania if they're producing such a great red.
Oh, and the Pinot coming out of Tassie is amazing, as well as Chardonnay. But, yeah, the Brim Creek Pinot that won the Pinot Noir Trophy, fabulous as well from Tassie. But, yeah, it is definitely worth a little hunt around down there.
Now, what about some of these other trophy winners that were actually reasonably priced? It shows the skill of the winemaker, as well as, you know, the fact that Australia is a great place to grow wine just about everywhere.
100%, and the skill of the winemakers, I suppose, but also I think the regionality is a big thing. Like, there was a Riesling which did really well, which is an Audi exclusive, but from Watervale in the Clare Valley, and which is renowned for producing great quality Riesling. So you don't have to go and blow the budget and to, you know, spend hundreds of dollars to buy great wine. Like, this is a $10 bottle of wine that was magnificent, like, you know, bright and fresh and all the, you know, varietal character and all the things we want to see in great Riesling.
Some of those wines too that were winners or trophy winners were like less than $15.
Yeah, there was a, apart from the Riesling, I'm trying to think now, but the value trophy went to a Grenache blend that was, you know, just sensational drinking. And Grenaches, as, like, if you're not a red wine drinker out there and you're really looking for that gateway into, like, you know, look, I probably should, you know, look a little bit more, like, Grenache is such a gateway, great variety to sort of lead you in down the path of drinking red wine, those Grenache blends, seek out the results and have a look. The Wollunga 100, who won Best Small Producer, they are making some of the most exciting and just delicious wines that you can find. I think red wine is in this country in a great space.
And what about the whites? Tell us about the real standouts there.
Obviously, Semillon and the Hunter Valley, close to my heart, being a Hunter Valley winemaker and have a little small brand in the Hunter. But that First Creek Semillon 17, the Oaky Creek, was just delicious. It is in the right space, like, with a little bit of age, but still beautiful and fresh. Their Vermentino, probably the most exciting class, was the other white varietals. And I may have just sort of blurted out Vermentino, and people might be thinking, what the hell is that? The alternate white varietals and people experimenting with the outside of the traditional, you know, Chardonnay, Semillon, Riesling is a really exciting space and something worth looking up. And if you haven't tried a Vermentino, I'd highly recommend seeking out the the first creek one, but also there was a really beautiful Albariño, which is a Spanish variety, came out of Mudgee, and Chenin Blanc from Western Australia that did really well. But yeah, really fun class and some exciting white wines.
Yeah, and some of those Italian wines, Spanish wines that we're seeing more and more varieties like that because of our climate heating up, and they do pretty well here.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, great growing is always going to be a part of what we do agriculturally in this country. But I think looking at varieties and trying to look at varieties that can tolerate, longer dry conditions and bigger heat waves, and looking for varieties that are less reliant on water is something that the great growers are looking at. And I know we're looking at we've got a small amount. We've got about 100 acres of vineyard that we plant in the Hunter, but yeah, putting in an acre or two of something to give it a go, and let's see what we can do to combat climate change, and in the Hunter, it's always going to be Semillon and Shiraz, but trialing new things is like Vermentino is a great way to kind of combat what's going on with the climate.
That's head wine judge of the Sydney Royal Wine Show, Michael Deulius there. Now, some of the other winners, the Albert Chan Memorial Prize for Best White went to Medhurst Wines for a 2024 Chardonnay. The James Busby Perpetual Trophy for Best New South Wales Wine went to De Bortoli Wines for the 2022 Dean De Bortoli Botrytis Semillon. So some big winners there at the Sydney Wine Show. It's coming up to 26 past 12.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Well, the chemical regulator's decision to phase out the use of a controversial herbicide in sugarcane has left growers struggling for answers. Cane growers have 2 years to stop using paraquat, even though farmers can still use the chemical at reduced rates on other broadacre crops. Sophie Johnson has more.
Confused and concerned. That's how sugarcane growers are feeling about the APVMA's decision to stop them using paraquat.
Growers have relied on paraquat for a number of years for a relatively cheap herbicide to do an excellent job. And the lack of alternatives means there's a lot of stress and concern about how they're going to continue with what is a normal farming practice to manage weeds in the cane production system. What it means is usually changing farming systems to something that's more expensive or sometimes even worse in terms of environmental outcomes.
That's Dan Galligan, Chief Executive of Cane Growers. Paraquat is used in sugarcane early in the crop because it kills plants quickly but doesn't linger in the soil, allowing the young cane to get established but not the weeds. Mr. Galligan says farmers are struggling to find a replacement.
Yeah, it'd be a dramatic change to the farming system, and that in the first instance probably means a lot more cultivation, a lot more use of other products and other herbicides, really applying more herbicide at different times of the year and cultivating more, which isn't a great outcome either. Effectively, we're going to have to use more herbicides and possibly increase our sediment loss off farms, which is not really what we want to try and do.
The Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority handed down its review of the chemical in June, which restricted its use but did not ban it altogether, except for in two crops, lucerne and sugarcane. The APVMA says it assessed each paraquat use pattern separately against current environmental safety standards. In sugarcane, it found unacceptable acute and chronic exposure risks to birds foraging in treated areas. Chair of Cane Growers Tully Bryce McDonald says growers don't understand why the risks can't be managed.
Yeah, it's a bit unusual. It's a bit bizarre when other crops are allowed to use it still at a reduced rate, when sugarcane is not mentioned. Well, it's not supported no longer on the label, which is a bit bizarre because you can use it in general use areas and like I say, other broad acre crops, but not allowed to use it in sugarcane. I think they should take a bit more time. We'll allow a bit more time in addition to what they've done already and do some more work on, one, availability of a similar product and conduct some new trials on what they're actually knocking it back on, which is potentially killing birds. But I've never seen any bird die from paraquat. In fact, I reckon there's more birds around than there ever was.
The APVMA said it does not assess crops based solely on where they are grown, but each use is assessed individually, which is why different crops in the same location can have different rules.
That story put together by Sophie Johnson. And staying with sugar cane, cane growers in the state's northeast have been picking the gaps in the weather, hoping for a better season than last year when the heavy rainfall, of course, caused that extensive damage. Well, there have been some interruptions this year. Chairman of the Clarence Cane Growers Association and New South Wales Cane Growers, Ross Farlow, told Lauren Bohane that he's staying pretty optimistic.
This season's a lot better than last year in two respects. The rain events have been smaller. Although they've been consistent, they've been smaller, and we've been able to manage it. But also the mill has been running a lot better. The reliability at the sugar mill has been wonderful this year. It's a credit to those the workers here to have it going as well as it is, bearing in mind it's a very, very old mill and a lot of moving parts, but it's going really well. So we're very happy with that.
That's Chairman of the New South Wales Cane Growers, Ross Farlow, now talking about the crush. The head of operations at the Harwood Sugar Mill and Refinery, Simon Smith, says that the crush is on track to wrap up on time in mid-November, so the weather not impacting that at this stage. It's coming up to 29 minutes to one, and before we go to the news headlines and also the weather details, we heard last week we were talking about the issue of floodplain harvesting on the program last week. We heard that the experts are saying that the legality of floodplain harvesting licenses and regulations appear to be doomed following evidence given to budget estimates. Greens MP Kate Fairman quizzed the Minister Rose Jackson about the suitability of floodplain harvesting licences and laws, as the government has lost a number of high-profile court cases with irrigators over enforcement. In estimates, the Minister stated she did not agree with the statement from Greens MP Kate Fairman that the floodplain harvesting laws and regulations are now flawed and had to be rewritten. Well, now the Minister has sent us a statement changing her tune somewhat. She's saying the New South Wales government intends to make changes to the regulatory framework for floodplain harvesting in light of recent disappointing legal decisions. She says we inherited a very challenging floodplain harvesting system from the previous government, who had years of false starts, disallowed regulations and parliamentary inquiries. She says that the government have endeavoured to create a fair and transparent system, but legal challenges have made that difficult now. And she says that the government will continue to make whatever changes are necessary to achieve the shared goal of a clear regulatory framework. So that statement from the minister in response to some of that discussion in estimates about the laws being fatally flawed and doomed. That was in estimates last week. It's coming up to 28 minutes to one here on the Country Hour, and it's time to get some news headlines now from Adam Storey, who's standing by. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The Premier has backed calls for an extension of the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, saying it would be money well spent. Last week, Federal Liberal MP Julian Lisa called for an extension of the Royal Commission. He said that would allow ministers and the Prime Minister to be called to give evidence. So there was a motion put to the federal parliament last week, but that was defeated. However, Chris Minns has now joined those calls today. Meanwhile, the Premier says he will work with the family of Lily Hooper on a special tribute to the 18-year-old after the discovery of her body in dense bushland last week. He says he wants to work with the family on how best to honour her. No suggestions at this stage. There was a memorial in the town on Friday night, though. A bit of traffic information. The Bells Line of Road in the Blue Mountains is closed in both directions at the moment after a truck tipped over at Mount Tomar. That's the main route linking Sydney and the west after the with that dam bridge on the Great Western Highway.
The causeway.
Still closed. Mm. Yeah. And One Nation MP Barnaby Joyce has clarified the party's net migration target is 130,000, saying that his colleague David Farley misspoke on the matter yesterday when interviewed on Insiders. He suggested that, yes, there would be a 130,000 migration target plus 100,000 skilled workers under established visa schemes. Barnaby Joyce says, no, the total net figure is 130,000.
Just to clarify that there.
Just to clarify that there.
No disagreement, just clarify.
Just a clarification. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Just made a mistake.
All right, thanks for that, Adam.
Okay.
You'll be back at one.
Yep.
Okay, we'll be listening. It's time to find out what's happening with the weather details. Yuan Park at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Marco.
So there's a high pressure system at the moment, but there's some rain on the way.
Yes, that's right. Currently, we are seeing a low pressure system centered over South Australia, and its associated trough, and these systems are forecast to enter the state's far west later today, later tonight or early Tuesday, while drawing tropical moisture from the north and bringing associated rain band, and with that we may see widespread showers or rain developing in the western half of the state today. Before this system heads east, that means wet conditions spreading to the rest of the state on Tuesday into early Wednesday, with moderate totals possible across the broad areas on the western side of the Great Dividing Range and adjacent western, and that includes the western inland plains as well. And, well, these rain or showers, as I said, will be first starting from the western end of the state today and then spreading to the rest of the state and for Tuesday. The peak period of this rain event looks set to be tomorrow, that means Tuesday, with widespread moderate falls, say about 10 to 30 millimeters across the western slopes and adjacent ranges and the further inland plains. And the focus, to be more precise, the focus area of rainfall on Tuesday morning looks set to be about eastern Riverina, southwest slopes, and the alpine ranges, where we may see 6-hourly totals about 20 to 40 millimeters in those areas. But higher totals, maybe up to 50 or 60 millimeters in 6 hours, may be possible on the alpine ranges and for the far for the higher parts of the southern slopes. So a severe weather warning for heavy rainfall is current for those areas, with the anticipation of rainfall developing tonight into tomorrow morning. Then the focus area of this rainfall will be shifting to the central west slopes and plains and the northwest slopes and plains and the nearby ranges for during Tuesday afternoon and evening as the rain band shift eastward. But this rain band will be followed by the development of severe thunderstorms across the west during Tuesday afternoon and evening that covers much of the western slopes and further inland plains that include places like, say, central west slopes and plain and Riverina and northern inland plains and so on. So watch this space, because this rain followed by thunderstorms may bring localized heavy falls and some risk of damaging winds, and there's even chance of larger hailstones.
Right, and so when you're talking about 10 to 20 millimetres for the Riverina, then moving into the eastern Riverina, maybe into the alpine areas, any in the southeast at all?
Yes, well, you mean the
like Monaro? So Monaro and Bega, that sort of area?
Probably not much, because these systems come from the west, and usually drops most of rainfall on the western side of the Great Dividing Ranges. But because those areas sit in the eastern side, that means the lee side from this northwesterly airstream, that means those areas probably will experience, rain shadow effect, that means only a few millimeters.
Yep.
Although, eastern Riverina and southwest slopes may easily see something like, 20 to 40 millimeters and right. Locally higher.
And moving, when it moves further north into the central west and then into the north of the state, are we going to see that sort of 20 to 40, or it might be a bit less?
Yes, it could be something like 10 to 30 millimeters at least, but, you know, seeing some localized 40-plus millimeters is also possible for places like, say, you know, Dabo or Tamos or, you know, Narrabri and Mori and Walgett and so on.
So 10 to 30 is possible?
Yeah, 10 to 30, I would say, is the most likely ranges, and the higher totals may be possible in the localized areas.
And Canamble, Walgett, Warren, someone's texted in asking about those areas. Much rainfall, similar sort of 10 to 20 yeah. millimeters there?
Yes, I think so, yes. So, you know, this rain band will be delivering these widespread moderate totals, maybe, as I said, at least 10 to 30 millimeters over those broad areas in the west. So, yes, Coonamble and those areas are likely to see similar rainfall ranges.
Similar to Dubbo as well, I guess.
Yes, yeah. That's right, yes.
What about Bourke and across to Moree? Because I know in Moree they want a bit of rain.
Yes, because this rain band extends all the way to southern Queensland, yes, Moree will get similar rainfall totals as well. But farther west, you know, places like Bourke, perhaps the most likely period is, you know, from, say, late Monday into Tuesday, and maybe 10 to 20 may be possible for those areas and for places like, Bourke and Cobar. But even farther west, the rainfall doesn't set to be higher.
And the coast not expecting as much.
Of course, that's right, yes, because of this rain shadow effect. So those forecast areas, as I said, will be on and west of the ranges.
Right. Okay, Juan, I thought I'd just get through a few of those questions there for people who are texting in to find out about the rainfall. Thanks for that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's coming up to 19 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, to beef news now, and over the weekend, US President Donald Trump says he's struck a deal to substantially lower the price of ground beef for working American families. President Trump says the US will allow up to 300,000 tons of ground beef to be imported with zero tariffs, and a commitment this beef will be sold at 25% below current market prices. Matt Brand spoke to meat analyst Simon Quilty, who says the plan lacks detail and the only winner could potentially be Brazil's cattle industry.
As of Friday, President Trump announced that there would be a 90-day waiver on out-of-quota tariffs for grinding meat going into America and 300,000 metric tons of it. The idea being, Matt, that influx would lower the value of ground beef in North America. I think that Brazil is the only winner out of this. And even then, it's probably questionable how much they'll put in. But of all the other import countries, whether it's Australia, Uruguay, Argentina, New Zealand, we're all sitting at about 70 to 75% of our allocation. And so there's really no upside for us or all those countries. It's really those that are currently out of access or paying the duty of 26.4%, which is Brazil and Japan.
Because Australian beef going into the US at the moment is going in tariff-free already, isn't it?
It is going in. You know, we're at about 75% of our allocation, and I would imagine at the pace we're going, Matt, that we would have been able to see the year out without any difficulty. So this reduction will have little to no influence on Australian beef value. What it does is, the concern is, lowers the overall price within the US market and therefore lowers Australia's beef export prices due to, you know, to a saturation of that lean meat market in America.
Mm. Under this deal, President Trump says this imported beef must be sold at 25% below the current market price. How's that going to happen?
That's a very good question. There is no detail given whatsoever, Matt. So it's difficult to know how they would monitor that and enforce it as well.
How much pressure do you think this announcement by the president's going to come under from that US cattle industry?
I think it's enormous, Matt. And you just have to look across you know, social media over the last 48 hours. And I think there's real truth to it, is that by lowering this tariff and having an influx of Brazilian beef, it is detrimental to overall cattle prices in America. And what they need is higher prices to incentivize retention of females, not lower prices.
That's Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends talking there to Matt Brann.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
G'day, I'm Nick Grimm. Join me soon for The World Today as bird flu crosses species and spreads to mammals. Australia passes yet another ominous milestone as the disease tightens its grip on the mainland. And Book Week, is it inspiring a love of literature in our kids? Or is it just a source of excess landfill and an annual bugbear for frazzled parents? Join us for those stories and more coming up soon on The World Today.
But here on The Country, our Hunter Valley horse studs have rolled out the red carpet for visitors and stallions over the weekend for the annual stallion parades. With joining decisions being made for next season, research has been long underway looking into if and how a warming climate is impacting on stallion fertility. An equine reproduction specialist says there's been a decline in the per cycle pregnancy rate over the past decade. University of Newcastle Associate Professor Zamira Gibb told Amelia Bernasconi it's important to assess production in this changing climate.
Obviously, a lot of research in many areas, not just biology, is focused on climate change and the things that are happening. The horse is of particular interest in me. I mean, it's my species of interest anyway. I have a long love of horses and I'm a rider myself, but we're dealing with an animal that, generally speaking, hasn't really evolved to deal with the heat conditions that we're looking at facing, and Australia can be quite challenging, certainly for thoroughbred horses, which tend to do better in cooler climates. So we have seen over the last 15 years or so continuing declines in per cycle pregnancy rates in the thoroughbred horses in the Hunter Valley, and heat stress. As we understand more and more about the physiology of heat stress and how it can influence whole animal health as well as reproductive performance and fertility, it became apparent that there was a lack of research in horses specifically. So most of the research there is in cattle, and it makes sense that if this affects cattle, and we know in laboratory studies using mice that it has profound effects on mouse fertility as a model, then it would make sense that it would also influence horses. So it seemed like something that we could probably track pretty easily. And we had existing relationships with some of the biggest stud farms in the Hunter Valley as research partners.
And obviously the industry want to be involved. They want this data because, you know, the Hunter Valley is the second most prestigious breeding ground for thoroughbreds in the world. So, and it all comes back to dollars and cents as well as animal welfare.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of these stud farms, I mean, it's not... The fact that heat stress isn't great for fertility is something that anecdotally has been pretty well accepted for a while. A lot of the bigger farms put in very expensive infrastructure to try and keep stallions cool over the hotter months. So involving, you know, air-conditioned barns and air-conditioned stables and things like that. But, you know, it's great if we can keep the horses in as natural condition as possible for their welfare. So if that's not necessary to keep them contained and under air conditioning, then, you know, they'd like to know. So we were really looking at ways to identify horses that are susceptible to heat stress, because we know from other animals that there's certain breeds or lines of cattle, for example, that can really well tolerate it and it doesn't seem to influence them. So those animals, you don't really need to micromanage. And we figured the same might be true in the horse as well. We found that between sort of 13 to 16%, I think, of stallions at any given time are heat stress susceptible. In these horses, you'll see a drop in fertility. So you'll see a steep decline in the number of mares that are actually falling pregnant. And that combined with some blood markers, so we were able to show that these horses had lower levels of systemic antioxidants. So this is like an oxidative stress-driven issue. There are a few little markers and indicators that we have now to identify those horses. But by and large, it's pretty simple. So we know that not being able to escape the heat over a couple of days is when the body starts getting really stressed. And anyone knows, you know, back before the days where we all had air conditioners, when you had those big heat waves where the nights stayed hot as well, it really knocks you around. So the ability to just have a few hours of cool in the middle of the night is key. The problem is when we keep horses stabled at night and we turn them out in paddocks during the day, they're actually being exposed to the hottest possible environments because the stables retain heat at night and obviously the paddocks are hotter during the day. So simple interventions could be reverse that turnout regimen. So some stallions, it would be better to turn them out in the fields at night and have them in stables, maybe under misters and fans during the day. Plant more trees. You know, we've shown that we know that trees can reduce temperature by up to 10 degrees in certain areas. And, you know, they're the biggest sort of straightforward strategies. But we've also identified a couple of feed supplements that can be used to address the DNA damage that happens in the sperm.
It's Associate Professor Zamira Gibb, who's an Australian Research Council Future Fellow at the University of Newcastle. On the Country Hour, it's 9:01. Well, if you think of Silverton in far west New South Wales, it was the home of the movie Mad Max 2, cars, the bikes and the interceptor there, or what makes up the history of this small community near Broken Hill. But now, as the Monday Music Festival winds down, which sees 15,000 people rock the plains of Belmont Station, the true characters of the area are being showcased. Em Jensen chucked on her boots and hit the Silverton Camel Farm and met Peter Devine.
I reckon I've had my farm and been here for about 9 years. It was 9 years this year.
What made you come to Silverton?
Well, started working in Broken Hill. I was there for 3 years. Used to come out to Silverton, as everyone does, on weekends or just to show visitors around. I was looking for a small farm to buy or some land to buy. And lo and behold, this place was for sale. So I bought it when I was still living in Broken Hill. I was still in the police force. I just wanted to have a farm where I could have some animals and live out of town. So moved here 2017, still in the police. And then a few years later, after I'd left the police, decided to do what I'm doing now. Now, it was a work dare to get my pet camels. My workmates dared me because I was living in the outback, of course, should have pet camels. So I got my first two pet camels within a month of buying the farm. And a few years later, decided to get more camels to do camel rides and all the other animals to do the farm visits and camping here.
Up the road from Peter's, Adrian Bennett runs a Mad Max 2 museum. The iconic 1981 movie was filmed just outside of Silverton and is the reason that Adrian moved to Australia from the UK.
That was really why we initially moved to Australia, but I never thought that, you know, I'd ever end up out here in Silverton with a museum, you know. But sometimes dreams can come true, you know. I just followed a passion and this is a result of it. And seeing the place evolve as well from what it was when we first opened to where we are now. So I'm pretty proud of, you know, what we've achieved here, really.
That's Adam Bennett from the Silverton Mad Max Museum finishing that story. Let's go to markets, Bendigo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Less numbers, back to 6,300 lambs and 2,870 sheep. Lamb job was similar to a few dollars better in places. A rate of $10.20 to $11.50 a kilo, still capturing the bulk of sales though. New season lambs to $354 for an export weight pen, then a few lines of fresh medium to heavy trades, $258 to $304. The bigger lines of suckers were again store to feeder types at $210 to $249 to be stronger. Heavier old lambs, $325 to $361, was a lot of Dorpers in today of mixed quality at $220 to $300. The sheep market was dearer, particularly for the trade merinos at $10 to $20 better, and these sold well into the high $8 a kilo range. Heaviest meat used still capped at $260 to $288 a head. Good merinos, $226 to $274. The average for all sheep sold was $236. The lamb average was $250. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Let's go to Corowa now.
Good afternoon. Numbers declined with just 5,040 sheep and lambs penned for today's sale. 1,050 were new season lambs, and quality remains mixed with the spring flush yet to come. Not all buyers were present, and the processors operating struggled to fill orders. Prices held across the top end of the new season lambs, with secondary types and old lambs coming back $10 to $15. Insufficient numbers to quote all categories. New season heavy trade 23 to 26 kilos, 248 to 315 to average 1190 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavy lambs $325 to $340. Old heavy trade lambs slipped $10, $235 to $318. Heavy lambs eased a few dollars, $300 to $344. Extra heavy export types slipped $14, selling from $348 to $370. Sheep numbers were small and competition was good. Extra heavy mutton remains very strong, with crossbred selling up to $310 and merinos to $278, averaging around 750 cents per kilo carcass weight. Trade sheep sold between $152 and $220. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Corowa.
Dubbo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers remain similar for 17,525 fed to good quality lambs. There were some good drafts of well-finished heavyweights and a reasonable supply of trades. There was also several larger pennings of merinos, mostly trade and light exports. The market is firm on the crossbreds and slightly stronger on merinos. A few pens of new season trade so far, 242 to 250 to average 1150. Old trade lambs, 20 to 24 kilos, 226 to 263. 24 to 26 kilos, 266 to 300. And they're averaging 1080. Heavy lambs are 30 kilos, 313 to 328, and over 30 kilos, 340 to top of 380. They're averaging between 1020 and 1080. Merino lambs averaged around $10. The trade weights, 225 to 265. Heavy weights have reached 296 to average 1040, and a pen of extra heavies topped out at 350. The balance of the lambs and 5,400 sheep are still to be sold.
To Wagga Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers might have declined back to 3,340, but prices went north with restockers stepping into the limelight. Feeder steers also met strong demand, while heifer prices kept climbing as the sale progressed. Heavy steers and bullocks sold to solid demand from both processors and feedlots due to the limited numbers. Steers 330 to 400 kilo back to the paddock jumped 48 cents, selling from $5 to $5.76. Lighter weight steers topped at $6.08 to average $1,416. The heifer portion averaged $1,318. Trade steers and heifers sold between $422 and $550. Feeder steers are 7 cents dearer, making from $450 to $558. Feeder heifers lightweight jumped 20 cents, $460 to $526, to average $515. The medium weights were back 4 cents, $390 to $540. Heavy steers to the processors surged 48 cents, $496 to $523. Bullocks fetched $4.38 to $4.88, jumping 28 cents. Heavy cows sold 7 cents dearer, $3.96 to $4.33. Leaner cows lifted 10 to 15. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
To Forbes Cattle.
Numbers lifted slightly this sale with agents yarding 1,231 head. Quality was mixed with a handy run of well-bred feeder cattle penned, along with the secondary types. Growing cattle were limited and the usual buyers are present competing in a firm to dearer market. Yearling steers to feed were firm to 5 cents better to sell from $4.80 to $5.78 for medium and heavyweights. The heifer portion was 5 to 10 cents better, selling from $4.50 to $5.20. Heavy steers and bullocks sold from $4.82 to $4.89. Grown heifers received from $4.47 to $4.68. Cows held fairly steady with heavy finished cows from $3.90 to $4.11. Planer types $3.65 to $3.84. The best heavy bull reached 420 cents a kilo. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
And Tamworth Cattle.
Only 715 cattle were scanned in Tamworth this week, 480 less than last week. It was a mixed quality yarding of predominantly cows and yearling type cattle. All major buyers were present with renewed optimism on the back of some rain over the weekend, with more predicted. Prime yearling cattle to the trade made to 538 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers to feed improved in quality and in price to make from 470 to 550 cents. Yearling heifers to feed made from 488 to 549 cents a kilogram. Light steers to the restocker were 10 to 15 cents dearer to range from 540 to 608 and average 589 cents a kilogram. Light heifers made from 346 to 530 cents and average 490 cents a kilogram. Prime grown cattle to the processor were limited and topped at 5.20 cents. 2 and 3 score cows to the processor were 15 cents cheaper. 2 score cows topped at 310 cents kilogram. 3 score cows made from 340 to 370 cents. 4 score prime heavyweight cows were 5 cents cheaper to make from 375 to 398 cents. And the best of the bulls got to 365 cents kilo. This is Hamish Hosgood in Tamworth for MLA.
Earlier in the program, Murray Watt, the minister, was saying that the federal government had received a request for some money for a rice factory, cracker factory in the Riverina. Sunrise asking for $15 million from the government to match the funds there. They would match the funds. Sunrise saying that money would not prevent the 78 job losses that we've seen or have been announced by Sunrise. It's 1 o'clock.